And hello, my friends. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show, where we do talk about everything in life. And no subject has probably been more, I won't say covered, because I've covered so many subjects so much, but no subject has been a perennial in my lectures and on my radio show as the subject of the sex differences. And the, I can't say the most recent book, but certainly very recent book. I only say it may not be the most recent because there were so many on the subject, but I'm very, very careful about which ones I pick, is The Female Brain. And it's, of course, Freud famously said that he died not knowing what women want. And we'll find out if Dr. Brizendine, Luann Brizendine, did I pronounce your name correctly?
Thanks for having me, Dennis, and it's Luann Brizendine.
Brizendine. Okay. I did it the French way.
You're awfully close. Yeah, you've got that little French accent.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. There's a neuropsychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco. The book is titled The Female Brain. She's founder of the Women's and Teens Girls Mood and Hormone Clinic. Now, Dr. Brizendine, I have an immediate question. On your jacket of the book, it says, women will come away from this book knowing that they have a lean, mean communicating machine, and having perused it, I can't say I read it all, I totally understand that part, but then it says, men will develop a serious case of brain envy.
Right, yes. I think the thing to first remember about what the difference between the male and female brain is that we all start off, you know, at conception with female-type brain circuits. And then the tiny testicles in the male fetus start to pump out lots of testosterone that go to marinate the circuits, changing them from female into male brain. So that by the time we're all born, we are either female-type brain circuits or male-type brain circuits. The male brain has, therefore, fertilization of certain areas of the brain to make them grow larger. For example, the area that's technically called the area for sexual pursuit. And other areas of the male brain may suffer from a decrease in size. And, of course, there are some scientists like Baron Cohen in London who believe that means that there's, because of a 1:8 to 1:16 ratio in favor of male and autism and language disabilities, that means there's a bit of a shrinkage in the language area of the male brain. So we're all born with female-type brain circuits, male-type brain circuits, whichever our genes have. Of course, the Y chromosome in the male will make it into a male brain.
All right, but I must say that I don't have envy of the female brain. In fact, knowing women to the extent that I feel that I do, and I don't claim to know them as well as I know men, nevertheless, I have to say that I suspect that if almost any man were given a female brain for a day, he would kill himself.
Well, I know that. You know, there's a prayer that Jewish men say every morning.
Yes, that's right.
They thank the Lord that they weren't born a woman. However, you know,
There is so much. I just want to make clear for those listening that this is not an anti-female. You could almost take it as a pro-female statement. But there is so much more going on at any one time in the female brain that it's no wonder that that at least they say more women are depressed.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that happens is that evolutionary psychologists theorize that the reason that we have that female brains have, for example, it's well known that we have a better memory for emotional detail, for example.
Shocking.
And we are able to pick up on emotional nuance and nonverbal body language and expressions better than the male is because we, male and female, have developed and evolved for millions of years in a slightly different evolutionary niche. And that means that although we are more alike than different, obviously, we have had evolutionary forces that have developed our brains to be a bit different. Now, females are, and still are and will be, as far as I can see around the corner in the future, the ones who get pregnant, experience pregnancy and then birth of children, and then suckling of children, and caring for what we call nonverbal infants for two, maybe, you know, a year or two before they even become verbal, means that the female in back in our Stone Age days, even, were the ones who were mostly caring for the offspring. And the men were out there, you know, keeping the group and the troop and the family safe by fighting off enemies. And the different niches that we've developed in and evolved in, evolutionary psychologists theorized that that is why we have developed slightly different gender-specific brain circuits.
Yeah, whatever the reasons, the evolutionary, God made it that way, what I'm interested in, and I know my listeners are, I'm sure, is what the differences are today, however they came about. So let me begin with this. One of the reasons, I want to be totally open with you, one of the reasons that I became alienated from the academic world, I did teach at the City University of New York. I went to an Ivy League graduate school.
That is a wonderful academic institution, City College, yes.
Right. Well, no, City University. It was actually City Brooklyn University. College of the City University of New York.
Okay.
That was the specific college. But in any event, one of the reasons was I was taught in every class that this came up that men and women were basically the same, and that the only reason that we have perceived differences is because of socialization.
The culture makes
yes.
it that way, right?
And I knew, without any studies, I knew I was being told something so obviously absurd that was one of the many things that alienated me from the academic world.
Exactly. So let me tell you. So I was an undergraduate. I'm 54, and I was an undergraduate at Berkeley, UC Berkeley, in the 1970s, and was what I call a first wave feminist, or a wave and a half, first and a half wave feminist.
Right, we're in the same wave. Go ahead.
So this was, you know, in my late teens and early 20s, and you know, it was the, I remember 1976 was the equal pay for equal work. That was supposed to be the ERA, the Equal Rights Amendment, that never passed, of course, but that there was a time when politics trumped even science. And strangely enough, I was also doing my degree in neurobiology.
Oh, it still trumps science. Forgive me. I want you to go back to that because of the Lawrence Summers affair.
Oh, right. I mean, well, but I was saying that this is kind of the unisex brain idea, and that we're all exactly alike biologically, is scientists have known for 50 years that we have different brain circuits. We have all, I mean, you look in the mirror, take your clothes off, you know that you're different. This is not rocket science. It doesn't take a neuropsychiatrist to tell you that, Dennis. However, I think that then those of us women, we wanted to give our children what we call gender-neutral toys, and we were going to raise a whole generation of kids where we gave feedback from the culture and our child rearing that was going to make them basically the same. And we women, of course, wanted to raise a generation of extra sensitive emotional men. That was our goal, until many of us, including myself, had boys. So when I had my son, I gave him a Barbie doll and also lots of other toys, of course. But his Barbie doll, you know what he did with the long legs, Dennis? He took those long legs and he proceeded to fight as a spear with those long legs.
Exactly. Exactly.
And believe me, this was not my intention. So many of us that were, I call myself a third wave feminist now because I have experienced the reality of what we are, how we are different in a biological way, and the type of what we call gender specific play, which is dubbed rough and tumble play in boys and in girls. They play these fantasy roles, you know, where they'll say, okay, now you be the mommy and I'll be the baby, or you can be the doctor, I'll be the patient. Now these kinds of role playing, fantasy role playing that girls do, boys don't do that. They pretend that they're a superhero fighting off the enemy. I mean, I don't know.
Oh no, if the girl is the patient, a lot of guys are willing to be doctor.
That's a little older age, though. The boys, they really get tired. I mean, in all cultures, this is an interesting thing. Eleanor Maccabee's work from 30, 40 years ago and has basically looked in all many, many, many cultures. And this playing with the same sex, boys playing with boys and girls playing with boys, they get bored with each other's play. They'll play a little while, and then they want to go off, and the boys want to be superheroes fighting the enemy, and the girls want to sit and do a different type of what's called relationship interaction and role play. So nobody really taught them or enforced them or told them they had to do
this. Exactly. All right, hold on for a moment. We've got to take a break. Take your calls here. I have a very simple question to ask Professor Luann Brizendine, neuropsychiatrist, UC San Francisco. And that is, isn't now the science of her book and all of the sophisticated, and it is sophisticated science, isn't it merely confirming the wisdom of the ages? Aren't we undoing what I have often called the age of stupidity ushered in with the baby boomers? 1-8-PRAGER-776. The book is The Female Brain, Luann Brizendine. I'm Dennis Prager. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show, talking about the female brain. And it is a book written by a neuropsychiatrist at the University of California, San Francisco. And she is Luann Brizendine. And it is spelled exactly as it is pronounced, a rare English word that is phonetic. Yeah, but you were never introduced that way.
Thank you, Dennis. That was a very academic explanation here.
Yes, well, I...
You never really...
Yes, you could take the guy out of the university, but not the university out of the guy.
So, you know, you say that the book is, of course, a book with lots of science in it. Did you find it hard to read?
No, not at all. No, my question to you, no, not at all. Oh, you write in a very appealing manner. And in fact, that's what the New York Times moronic review of your book, and it was a moronic review. I read it twice. And I can only have imagined you sitting there thinking, did this woman read my book? I mean, she said one of her critiques was you only gave six sources for one point. And I thought, well, I think six is enough.
Yeah, that's right. Well, you know, every person is entitled to their opinion.
Well, you know why, though? Because
she thought I wrote it in too much of a friendly style.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So that's
she
not the danger.
She wanted me to write much more academically.
Well, not only that, yeah, but also, the key is when she dismissed you for breezy generalizations. I do not assume that you know my show or anything, but you must know I have a motto about generalizations. Generalizations are the mother of wisdom. If you can't generalize, you're an idiot.
Right. I mean, and you know, a lot of people will say, well, gosh, you're just reinforcing stereotypes. I think what's important to know, just as you say about generalization, stereotypes have a kernel of truth right at their core.
Yes, exactly.
You don't want to use them.
Right.
You don't want to use them to straitjacket someone that's their own individual unique self. You know, you're not going to
say, that's right.
Oh, because you're black, green, yellow, green, male,
yes,
female, whatever,
that's
you can
right.
or can't do something. We know from experience in this that we can all, males and females can be astronauts, we can be scientists, politicians, we may not go there, but I know.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, we can be lawyers and doctors, we can do all the same things, so it's not anything we can't do.
No, but that's not the point. The point is that we're so different. By the way, your story about your son, about giving him a Barbie doll,
mm-hmm.
Number one, I will be reciting this forever. So please know that aside from the immortality you will reach through your own work, you will reach it through my publicizing you. Secondly, do you now look back at that with a little embarrassment?
Well, I look back at, I mean, the thing is, you know, it's like anything in our lives, and you don't know till you know. I mean,
yeah, but we did know. Only people, you were at Berkeley, so you couldn't know. It was a fount of nonsense.
You know, but in high school, I used to wear matching shoes and purses and that kind of thing. And then maybe around whatever year that was, we all started wearing blue jeans and hiking boots and down coats by the time we went to Berkeley. So you dressed unisex, you acted unisex, you assumed everything was unisex, you had a unisex brain. And if you didn't say it was unisex, it means you could not claim equality.
Yeah. Well, that's the point. That is the tragedy of same and equal. Equal.
But, you know, it may have been a stage. Let's honor that time in social political history. I mean, it may have been a stage we all needed to go through.
Well,
we
differ on that one.
We may have taken it too far.
Yeah, no kidding.
Obviously, we did take it too far. I think in the female brain, you know, I write about that because I think we went way over the edge.
Why are women so much more likely to be depressed?
Well, you know, that's, as you know, so I trained in psychiatry at Harvard in the 1980s, and the way I got interested in aspects of the female brain being different from the male brain is just this point that you're bringing up, which is that there's worldwide is about a 1.6 to 2.0 ratio, or whatever culture you look into, of women having more depression. But, you know, it doesn't start until about 12 to 14 years old, which is when the menstrual cycle starts. It's when puberty starts in girls. So it isn't entirely sorted out. We believe, bottom line, it has to do with the fluctuations of estrogen and progesterone in the female brain that turns on a whole different cascades of genes that may have also indeed something to do with being more emotionally in tune with nonverbal infants, or being able to pick up on emotional detail and nuance may also predispose women to being able to fluctuate more with their own moods, and therefore leads to a bit more depression as being the downside of being more emotionally in tune and more empathic.
Are you prepared to say that, again, in a breezy generalization with the acknowledgement of exceptions, that with any given couple, male, female, that there is the male mind is more apt to be reason-based than emotion-based?
Well, I see lots of couples in my office, and of course that is the typical, stereotypical complaint of the traditional male. And, they see me also for, he wants more sex and she wants less, but that's an old story as well. But the issue of his feeling, why can't a woman be more like a man, right? That's what the guys feel. It's like, why can't she just be more reasonable? And really, a lot of times, what men don't understand is that we women, I actually put a yellow sticky on my husband's computer, Dennis, and he's really a linear thinker. He's a very famous neuroscientist himself, and he is a very linear thinker. And he, whenever I come to him with some kind of a complaint or problem, he immediately goes into what I call linear logical problem solving mode. He doesn't take a breath to say, oh, honey, I know how you feel. So I put that on a yellow sticky, and he does that. He says that sentence to me before he launches into problem solving.
I salute you for acknowledging that that's what you want to hear from him.
Do you know what? I tell you, even though I know it's...
With all your degrees and all your sophistication,
And his, too. I know what I need to hear from him is that sentence
right.
first.
Right, not where the aspirin is.
That's right.
First, I empathize with your headache.
Or just like, honey, I know how you feel. And then he can go into problem solving. Oh, he's brilliant at problem solving.
Right.
His husband's a genius, so he's really good at that. And also, I sit with couples and I say to her, how do you know that he loves you?
And
she will say, because he wants to talk with me about how I feel. And I turn to him and I say, how do you know she loves you? And he says, because she wants to have sex with me.
That's right. That's right. So here is the question. Since men are so aware of that and women are so unaware of the other, it's a good thing to make women aware of the fact that men translate the woman's willingness to have sex into she loves me.
And the couples, when they are sitting, they're only in my office usually because they do indeed love each other.
Right.
And it is shocking to each of them to hear that from the in all sincerity, from the other person's mouth, that comes to each of them as a shock. And I think as a woman, one of the things I've learned by doing
I think women are more shocked by that than men are shocked by the fact that women want to talk with them.
Well, actually, the men are quite shocked, too, that she doesn't say because he wants to have sex with me.
Fair enough.
He's expecting that she'll say that, yeah.
Yes, exactly right. This is so important. We're going to take calls as soon as we get back now. From around the country, 1-8-PRAGER-776. I tell you, I'm going to leave that. I really want to write on this male sexual nature thing. It could help people a lot. The Female Brain is the book. You're listening to the Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. Dennis Prager here, talking about the female brain with the author of the book on the very subject, the female brain, Luann Brizendine, M.D. Are you also a Ph.D.?
I'm an M.D. I did my undergraduate degree in neurobiology at Berkeley, so that's my other training. Besides,
yeah. No. I'm not holding it against you. I don't. I'm a mere B.A. holder, so I'm a grad school dropout.
Well, Dennis, reviewing 1,008 studies to put this book together and write it in a very up close and personal way was quite a task. About a three-year task.
I'm amazed that you could do it in 3 years. So we're talking about male-female difference, especially the female brain here, and I'm going to take some calls now from various parts of USA. 1-8-PRAGER-776. We begin in Philadelphia. And Ray, hello, Ray, Dennis Prager, and Dr. Luann Brizendine.
Hi, Dennis. Hi, Luann. How are you?
Hi, Ray. How are you doing today?
Good. I want to pick your brain about a little theory I have. Do you think that maybe increased women's depression could be something to do with the fact that they are maybe a girl's growing up and she wants to be a mommy and she wants to work in the home and she wants to take care of her family and she feels constant pressure from other women around her that that would make her a second-class citizen?
Well, I think you're bringing up an interesting issue about how we all read and interpret what in a particular, you know, historical point in time we're living in our culture, right? And so you're bringing up a point that maybe she isn't feeling sort of validated and embraced with her choices about being a stay-at-home mom, and she's feeling that somehow that makes her not good enough. So I think anytime any of us get feedback from our culture or from the social groups that we relate to that we're not doing something quite right, it gives your self-esteem a bit of a hit. So I think I understand that you're saying that she's not feeling sort of reinforced and validated in her choices. So I can think that we have to honor that is going to make her feel
all right. So let me ask you, Dr. Luann, let me ask you a question here. If feminism was dead wrong on our being the same, which led you to give your kid, your boy, a Barbie doll, and I totally respect your honesty in relating the story, it was dead wrong on that incredibly important concept. There was a serious strain of feminism that argued we're both in the same generation, that a woman without a man is like a fish without a bicycle. There is a serious part of feminism that tells women who stay at home, just as you were saying, that they are really unworthy in some ways, and it causes whatever it causes in terms of sadness or even depression. So what is the great good that feminism did?
You're bringing up a fabulously interesting stress, and I just got back from the book launch in Germany, where it just hit the bestseller list there too. And actually, the German government in January just put a new law in where men get paid by the government to stay home for up to 14 months with their newborns. So dads can do that too there now. And what they're trying to do, I mean, this is the first time in million years of human history that we have a choice to have 0, 1, 2 children. Remember, women used to have 14, 15 pregnancies and 10 babies, and die by the average age of 49 in the year 1900. You know, so we're all of a sudden at a point and a place that we have a longer lifespan. Women are not going to only be home for their entire lifespan raising children. So the issue is coming up about how to honor the time, those years that women are going to want to be raising their children, having their children, staying at home, maybe being somewhat flexible on doing something part-time or whatever it is she chooses to do, and to have all parts of society honor the choice of that individual woman, mother, and it's a couple's decision too. Remember, we can't entirely leave the dads out of this, Dennis. I mean, there's this evolution to a decision. Some mothers may decide to be stay-at-home moms for all of their life up till 80, 90 years. They may decide to be stay-at-home grandmothers, but that is a couple's decision often, and it's also a decision about what availability that there is in the workplace. I mean, if I tell young women, they ask me, what should I ask in my interviews? I'm getting recruited out of Princeton, business school by all these Wall Street firms. What's the key question I need to ask if I want to continue to work? But I said, well, look, ask the question, do they have on-site sick child care for those days when you need to have some flexibility?
Yeah, all right, but the point, all right, that's all fine, and I mean it's fine. I'm not dismissing it at all. But I just repose the question, what are the great benefits that feminism has brought since you and I agree to three terrible consequences of the movement? The Female Brain is the book. And I'm Dennis Prager, and we continue. All righty, everybody. Final segment here with Dr. Luann Brizendine. And she is an MD, psychiatrist, neuropsychiatrist, University of California, San Francisco. And her book is The Female Brain. And it's a book that is easy to read and has a great deal of research in it to establish that, folks, there is no such thing as a unisex brain. something that when we used to say, we were called sexist. I have lived to see a lot of terminology bandied about that was undeserved. Maybe nature is sexist in that it did give, in fact, different brains to each sex. I posed the question, and you don't really have to answer it because it's not really germane here, but it's really just an open question. And I think, because I do think about it, because feminism said, well, it's given women equality, and it's, you know, in the final analysis, while there were extreme elements, it's an overwhelmingly positive force. But I'm not sure that that's true.
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things to note is that, I mean, I remember that I decided that when I got married, had my child, we're going to do this 50-50 thing. We're going to do 50%. I was going to do half, and he was going to do half, and we had that all worked out, right? Then the baby came along, and guess what? The baby prefers the adult with the breasts.
Yeah. Well, I'm not even sure that because I think it's true even for women who don't breastfeed. I'm not even sure the breast is the specific issue.
No, but I put that in quotations in that you know, if there's an aspect to the formation of what's called the maternal brain circuits and maternal brain behavior that gets really consolidated during pregnancy and at birth. That you know, it's been made that way for millions of years, and that's why
right.
We've been such a successful species.
So in light of that, and you really don't have to respond. I just want to say to my listeners, in light of that, we're not nuts. Those of us who think that the ideal ought to be a man and a woman raising a child. I mean, if the moment you say that a baby prefers the female at the onset. One is arguing that two men cannot give what a man and a woman can give to a baby.
But, you know, I think one of the things you got to realize is that, you know, if the options of putting a kid in an institution or whatever, then two loving adults can really provide something.
Yes,
better for kids.
Yes, but if that is so rarely the option, and it's never with newborns, it's only with older kids anyway.
Yeah,
newborns have always a home to go to. All right, here's a guy.
The daddy brain, Dennis, is a really important thing, too.
I mean, yes, that's my point. I agree. That's what I say.
Dads get very, I mean, there's a huge, enormous protective attachment that dads get to their babies as well. So we don't want to leave you dads out.
Well, no, I know that. And that's why I always argue that you need both. I believe me, as a father of three, I don't have to be convinced about the importance of my role in my children's lives. I don't suffer from that problem. It's an interesting question from
I think
Craig.
We need to honor it. We need to honor that.
Thank you. Correct. Craig, Phoenix, Arizona. You're on with Luann Brizendine and Dennis Prager. Hi.
Hi, Dennis. Hi, Luann.
Hi. How are you doing?
You stated early in the conversation before we got off on some of the other things that the women brain is emotionally in tune with those around them. I'm just curious, if that's true, then why don't you see women triumphing in these poker tournaments where reading other people's emotions and
that's a great question. Of course, you know that what you do is you get your skills, what we call the poker face, right? So you try to inhibit all of your natural emotional experience. That's how you get to be good at these things. I do understand what you're saying. You know, there's a little brain cells in your brain called mirror neurons, as if you're looking in the mirror, and they're in our brain and they jiggle along with a certain amount of activity when you're looking at the face of another person. They actually pick up the emotional nuance. And we know from brain studies that they basically are more active in the female brain than in the male. So that's one of the brain scan studies that came out last summer in 2006 that showed that they're more active in the female brain. So that's where some of this comes from. But I'm sure that, you know, there's all kinds of situations in poker games. I'm not a very good poker player myself because I can't tolerate, I don't have enough patience for it.
Yeah, well, I'm not a good one either, but I don't know how to bluff as well. You're right. So he did point out a very interesting, by the way, as a female, because you are a female as well as a doctor, and you celebrate that fact from what I can hear.
Absolutely.
Yes,
yeah.
That's great. Does it disturb you when you point out that women have a thought about sex every couple of days and men do every minute?
Well, you know, the reality is that if you do what's called aged matched couples, so you're 20, you're 30, you're 40, you're 50, 60, and you're the same age as your spouse, on average, just kind of per day, they look at the average male has about three times as many thoughts per day about sex. Now, remember, on a female's hottest day that we call it, which is a couple of days before ovulation, it's when her testosterone level is highest and she gets a lot more flirtatious. She's a lot more interested in attracting male attention. She might put on a little more lipstick, maybe wear a slightly shorter skirt, whatever it happens to be, that women get much more interested in pulling sexual interest towards her during the few days before ovulation, which, of course, makes good sense if you want to get pregnant.
Yeah, go on. So I'm asking you personally, just on a personal level, because it has been my experience that this is a disturbing feature of life to many women, totally understandably.
Right. Well, you know, between ages 9 years old and 15 years old in the male, the testosterone level goes up 25 times.
Yeah.
And it starts to run those right. male brain circuits in the area for sexual pursuit, and it starts to give you fantasies about sex and give you fantasies about females.
I'm talking to Luann, and I'm getting a response from Dr. Brizendine.
Well, okay. So, yes, it is disturbing. Females feel like all guys ever want is sex.
Yes, exactly.
Guys, she never wants sex, you know?
Yeah. Look, you were the one who said that's one of the two things they say at your office.
Absolutely.
When they come in. Yes, that's why I know I can help
them.
It's
a major disagreement.
I know, but I actually have solutions, but that's a separate issue. Listen, yes. Congratulations on your book.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're a delight.
I hope The Female Brain is fun for your listeners to read.
Yes, well, and you're a delight to hear as well. Thank you so much.
Likewise. Thanks for having me, Dan.
You're very welcome. Bye-bye. The book is The Female Brain. I'll take some calls and give you some final thoughts of my own when we return. You are listening to The Dennis Prager Show. Hi, everybody. You're listening to The Dennis Prager Show. I thoroughly enjoyed that dialogue with Luann Brizendine, Dr. Brizendine, Professor Brizendine, and her book, The Female Brain, which is up at PragerRadio.com. You know, it's both exhilarating and frustrating to have these interviews with eminent scientists confirming what my grandmother, who never went to high school, I'm not sure she went to elementary school, what she knew about the differences between men and women. I always used to say, my grandmother, who never went to school or only went to elementary school, knew more about men and women than the average PhD in psychology does today. It's very distressing. I mean, here you have this woman who went to Berkeley, to Harvard, teaches University of California, San Francisco, say, we were taught wrong. We have not at all overcome the distortions of life that have been purveyed as truth at the university. We have not come close to doing so. It's in the moral realm. It's in the political realm. It's in the historical realm. It is about men and women. It's all pervasive. And now it has fluctuated infiltrated down to the high school level, where agendas are taught, not truth. And there was an agenda when I went to college. The agenda was to teach that men and women are basically the same because of the terribly foolish idea that equal means same. And to this day, this is a precious professor in trying to disabuse people of it, but she was totally lambasted in the New York Times book review, which I cited to her, and of course she knows about it. It's her own book. She obviously read it. Oh, the New York, breezy generalizations, reinforces stereotypes. Folks, there's many stereotypes have a lot of truth. That bad people will use stereotypes stupidly or just meanly is a separate issue. But yes, those generalizations are true. And you are taught at college not to make generalizations, which means you can't have wisdom, you can't see patterns, you can't understand the human condition. It is bad for your brain, the university. It is a tragedy of staggering proportions. And then the notion that men and women have the same things to give, so it doesn't matter as long as they give love. And here you have a woman at UC San Francisco, the heart of the world that says that, saying, no, men and women have utterly different things to give to their kids. This is Dennis Prager.